Professor Buzz Scher discusses the U.S. Supreme Court decision expanding protections for transgender and gay workers. This is The Legal Impact, presented by the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, now accepting applications for JD graduate programs and online professional certificates. Learn more and apply at law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, what are the cases that were decided on this week on this issue?
The case was Bostic versus Clayton County, Georgia. It was a lawsuit filed by three individuals because in one way or another, they were discriminated against by their employer. The basic legal provision that was at stake was Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Let me read what Title VII says. It says this, basically. It makes it unlawful for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or to just discharge or otherwise discriminate against any individual because of such individual's sex. That's what the statute says. You can't fire someone because of their sex. So that's the law. The cases, Bostic himself was gay, and he worked for the county, Clayton County, and he joined a gay softball league, and he was fired because he was determined to be gay. The second person, whose name I can't remember, mentioned in a conversation that he was gay, and he was thereby fired. The third person worked for a funeral home, and came out and said, from now on, she was a trans woman, she's now deceased. She came out and said, from now on, I am for all purposes a woman, and ask that you recognize that. And she was fired because of that. So all three of them, in different ways, were fired because of their sexual identity. The question before the court was, does that language cover it or not? Now, one court, the appellate court system within which Georgia is, the 11th Circuit, found that Bostic could be fired and it didn't violate Title VII. The Circuit Court of Appeals in two other jurisdictions, the two other cases, found that it was a Title VII violation. And that's how the case got up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a classic example of why cases get taken by the U.S. Supreme Court when there's a split in the lower circuit courts of appeal. And so that's why the case was up there. And it was a 6-3 decision saying the firing of those three people, each of them was a Title VII violation. They were fired because of their sex. Now, the three in the minority,
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to that, because that's definitely fascinating with regards to this case especially, but how does the ruling protect workers going forward?
It protects everyone from being fired because of their sexual identity. That is, if you identify as...
So strictly across the board, the sexual identity, including their, but also how they consider themselves from a gender perspective, too.
Correct. One of the, Amy Stevens was a trans woman. She identified as a woman, putting aside her, biological status at birth. It covers transgender people. Sex, the word sex covers any sexual identity. Effectively, when you read the majority opinion, that's very clear. And it was, to be honest, it was quite a surprise to many LGBTQ advocates around the country. There was a deep, deep concern that the four more moderate or more liberal judges, depending on how you view it, were going to be outvoted by the five conservatives on the court. That turned out not to be the case. Not only did Chief Justice Roberts, who in some people's minds was the most likely one to side with the four moderates on the court, but also Justice Gorsuch sided with the moderates on the court. And he, in fact, wrote the majority opinion in the case. So it was the outcome in terms of two from the conservative wing voting with the moderates slash liberals was a surprise to many. There was not despair, but there was not a great deal of hope for the outcome that turned out.
Now, does this specifically just in hiring situations with regards to the Civil Rights Act of 64 change the definition of what sex means, or does this have larger ramifications?
No, what's interesting about the case, let me frame the case. This isn't a case about the U.S. Constitution and discrimination under the U.S. Constitution. It's not a constitutional case. It's about what does that word mean in the statute? Very often in the constitutional parsing of words, what does a word mean that's in the Constitution? You get into this very fraught discussion about originalism. What did the people who wrote the word mean when they wrote it back in 1792 or back in 1865 or 1866? Or in 2018? What did they mean when they were writing it? And that's a way to look for meaning with a word that's otherwise vague. What was so interesting, but that's not the circumstance here. What was so interesting about what the court said is they rejected, by and large, that whole debate and said, there's no ambiguity about what the word sex means. It doesn't matter what it meant to the people who wrote the law back then. You only look at legislative intent if there is ambiguity about what the word sex means. And the court was very clear in saying, no ambiguity here. It includes all sorts of sexual identity. You know, all three of those people were fired because of their sex.
And I'm assuming the dissenting opinion disagrees with you on that.
Yeah, there are two dissenting opinions, one by Justice Kavanaugh and the other by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. And they delve deeply into the meaning of words and originalism and textualism and interpretive jurisprudence for words. But they tried to import a lot of the constitutional conversation into understanding the statute. But the majority would have none of that. It was very interesting. It's a different form of textualism. It basically says, well, the statute says sex, they must mean sex.
Now, how would that be different? I mean, are there other decisions to kind of see? I'm a little apprehensive of the fact that how is this different from a constitutional decision?
It's not the Constitution.
And so because of it's a statute, they're given more leeway to interpret.
I put it differently. The words where they go about doing that in the Constitution or the phrases or the clauses they go about doing that in the Constitution, there is uncertainty about what they mean. Let me give you an example. The Confrontation Clause in the Sixth Amendment says, everyone shall have the right to confront the witnesses against them. Okay? Seems, if that phrase is interpreted as in theory it means, then you would never allow hearsay in a criminal case. Because the person who said the out-of-court thing, if they weren't in court, they couldn't be confronted by the person against whom the statement's being offered. The courts never interpreted the statute to mean that. They've understood that there's some additional words. They've understood that to not mean that. You know, you can't. So constitutional interpretation is different than statutory interpretation. And statutory interpretation plays very much off of you take the plain meaning of a word as it's written. And you assume that the legislature intended the word to mean what its plain meaning is. Only when you start to get statutes that use the word unreasonable or, you know, something like that, like, or does this person have a duty of care, you know, or the word privacy in a statute, where privacy does not appear in the U.S. Constitution. But privacy, in a, the word privacy in a statute or unreasonable or duty of care, you know, those, it's on their face, it's a little unclear, more than a little unclear what the word unreasonable means. So you get that, then you look at the legislative intent when that's going on. That was not the case. The majority opinion said unambiguously, that's not the case here.
What sort of leeway do you predict will be given to religious organizations or companies like that? Like Hobby Lobby, for example, is something in the past. It's not directly this, but there was religious leeway given on the decision. An obvious example with this specifically would be like a religious school with an individual teaching ethics-based curriculum or something like that. Do you predict there to be cases or decisions going forward to kind of narrow down what exactly this protects?
I think there'll continue to be challenges from the religious right in terms of what they mean under Title VII, what religious liberty means under Title VII. I really don't have any prediction. It's not an area of my specialty, so I try and shy away from predictions and things that I don't know much about, although it makes it easier to predict. I think that litigation is going to go on and on. I know the religious right and the conservative movement is all a flutter about Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch abandoning them. One conservative commentator dramatically overstated the effect of this opinion, the Bostick opinion, by saying the conservative legal movement is over. So the sky, once again, the sky is falling, but things will settle
down. Typical 2020 politics.
Right. Things will settle down, and we'll see how these things play out going forward.
Thanks for listening to The Legal Impact, presented by UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. To help spread word about the show, please be sure to subscribe and comment on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify.